This program may be freely duplicated and distributed. The following is an interview conducted at the Veterans for Peace National Convention in Boston, Massachusetts, July 25, 2004. Speaking will be Dennis Stout, along with Jim Brown, Christopher Myers, and Stephen Sherrill.
First of all, for the record, why don't you just identify yourself, and we'll just go around the circle and do that.
Okay, I'm Dennis Stout, currently from Phoenix, Arizona. Formerly with the 1st Battalion, 327th Infantry of the 101st Airborne during 1966 and 67.
I'm Jim Brown. I'm from San Diego, and I'm Veterans for Peace president down there. I was a Marine Corps lieutenant, artillery, but I spent most of my time in infantry at Delta 1-1, 1969, just south of Da Nang.
I'm Chris Myers. I was a civilian in Vietnam. I worked for the Agency for International Development in 1967 and 68 down the Mekong Delta. I got to know Dennis Stout as a member of the Smedley Butler chapter of Veterans for Peace here in Boston back in 1988 and 89 when Dennis lived here in Boston. I became aware this winter that this Toledo Blade series was out and talking about atrocities in Vietnam and that Dennis's name had been mentioned. I saw it in an email letter. Somebody had seen his name with a question posed, did anybody know Dennis Stout? Was he a member? And so I got in touch with Dennis, and because I helped arrange this convention here, was able to have Dennis come speak to us at a workshop that he did 2 days ago with Dan Ellsberg.
Dennis, why don't you start off by talking about the workshop, what the theme was, and basically try to retrace your steps from the interview that, or from the workshop that you did with Daniel.
Well, the workshop was on war crimes, cover-ups, and international law. What I did was recount the my story of the war crimes and my attempts to report them over the years and the investigations that have taken place of those war crimes. And I start out by giving the 8 war crimes that I reported to the Civil Investigation Division, which are the detectives of the Army. They investigate cases and then move them on to the Army prosecutor for either a recommendation of prosecution or not. I first tried to report these in 1967 while I was a member of an infantry unit, and after one of the crimes, the rape and murder of a girl about 17, I walked cross-country about 2.5 or 3 clicks by myself to get to a base camp to report these, and I went to my sergeant major and tried to report them, and he said, well, you better keep quiet or you'll get a lot of good people in trouble. So I went to my captain and told him about them, and he said, you better shut up about that kind of thing. So then I went to the chaplain, thinking he would care, he once a month got to fly to Saigon for a chaplain conference, and I thought he could get word out and get investigators to come in and check this out. Instead of doing that, he reported me to the sergeant major as a troublemaker. So I was called into a meeting several hours later with the sergeant major, my captain, Captain James, and another captain that I was just, he was introduced to me only as a captain from general staff. And the exact words I was told was, Stout, if you didn't have such a good combat record, you'd be dead already. But if you say another word about this, you're not coming back alive from the next operation. Do you understand that? And I said, yes, sir. He said, dismissed. And I turned around to leave, and the other captain from general staff said, oh, and by the way, we're taking away your medals. And I said, big deal. Left the tent. So I should describe the nature of our unit. There were only 2 airborne units in country, the 173rd and the 101st. And we were a light brigade, which means there were only 3 battalions. And there were only 3 battalions, I believe, of the 173rd. Our unit was General Westmoreland's old unit, and he had moved up to be commander of all U.S. troops in Vietnam, commander of MACV, it was called. And so he would send the people he knew from West Point down to serve with our unit. And any officer that was airborne qualified and infantry qualified to get their next promotion had to serve with a combat infantry unit. So since there were only 3 battalions, There was only one opening for a general, three openings for battalion commanders, and then, you know, captains and majors down the line. And all of our officers were West Point. So, and we got new officers all the time because they had to rotate them through quickly to get, as it was put by the former, one of our former colonels, Colonel Hackworth. He said recently in a newspaper interview that body count was the way you got your ticket punched. You had to get a certain level of body count to get your next promotion. So we got a new general every 30 days. We got new light colonels every 45 days. I mean, bird colonels every 45 days. And new light colonels either every 30 days or 45 days. Our lieutenants served 4 months with us before they went on to something else. If they lived, they died quite frequently. And our captains served 4 to 6 months before they moved on. So we were constantly getting rotating new officers who had to get their body count and, if possible, a little bit of publicity to help move them to their next rank. So, I was kept quiet through that period. I served out my time at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, training troops. And then when I got out of the Army in February of 1969, the My Lai story broke shortly after that. And My Lai had occurred in the same valley where we had done this stuff, further toward the mouth of the valley, committed these crimes. So I went public immediately with the 8 war crimes that I could most closely document. I witnessed a lot more than this, but these are the ones where I had ID cards of the people killed. See, the South Vietnamese government would issue these laminated ID cards to people that were considered loyal citizens. And, of course, we didn't give that any standing. But I had ID cards of some of the people killed, location on the ground, sometimes within 50 meters, and the names and unit numbers of the people who committed the crimes. And those are the only 8 that I reported to the CID, because I wanted to stick to what I could absolutely prove, I felt. The crimes were the rape and murder of a young girl that I spoke of earlier, where she was seized at a road guard operation, raped and beaten for 2 nights, and then taken out and shot. They took her right outside of our little perimeter and told her to run so that they could shoot her. And she wouldn't run because she knew what they were going to do. So they backed away from her and threw a grenade that rolled up at her feet. And when she saw the grenade, she used one hand to cover her eyes and the other hand to cover her chest. When the grenade went off, it tore off one leg and shredded the other one. But she was still alive, so the guys walked up and shot her twice to finish her off. I also, at that same road guard place, one guy decided he wanted to try to skin someone. So he caught an old man and tied him to a tree and began skinning him at the top of his left shoulder and down his chest. And he got about 3 inches down when the guy passed out. So then he revived him by slapping him and throwing water on him. And when he came to, he tried to skin him again. And he only got about another inch or so. And the guy passed out again, so he shot him. After he shot him, he said, well, he's no fun anymore.
Jesus.
So one of my sergeants, Sergeant David Kalu, we had captured a guy asleep in his hammock with his rifle leaning against the tree and 2 bundles of punji sticks rolled up under the hammock. And after we captured him, he tied him to a tree and then tied cords around his upper arms and around his thighs and then took an axe and started to chop him apart from the bottom up. And eventually chopped off his arms and legs and head and piled them on the trail as a message to any gooks that came down the trail.
Jesus.
At one point, I captured an old woman that could barely walk and couldn't see very well. We had chopped her garden up, all the melons and squash and things, and we saw movement out in the garden while we were having lunch, and she was out there picking up the pieces and stacking them back together. And the guys were going to shoot her, but I decided to just go up and capture her, I guess, you know. So I walked up, and she saw me coming and tried to run, but all she could do was barely shuffle, not even as fast as I could walk. So I went up and tapped her on the shoulder and motioned for her to come with me and took her over to where the guys were. And they were teasing me about, what are you going to do with her now, you know. So I got on the radio, and I called the S2, which is the intelligence portion of the battalion, because we happened to be battalion online at that time, moving through the valley, which is a rare formation to use. But so the S2 wasn't far away. And he asked what the problem was, and I said I had a special situation. So about 15 minutes later, a specialist fourth from the S2 showed up, and he said, "Where's your special situation?" And I showed him the old woman, and he said, "You called me up here for that." And he went over and grabbed her by the back of her dress, right behind her neck, and took her over to the side, pulled out his .45, and shot her in the back of the head. Then he came over and grabbed the radio and said, "This is S2 Bravo Oscar, 1VC KIA, out." He hung up the thing and he said, "That's how you handle your special situations."
Jesus.
So.
Were you like just by yourself with the major and a couple other guys? Or was,
no.
There, was there like a whole platoon
just
laying around right there?
We had about seven or eight guys there at that time, yeah. We were moving through this area where the houses were a little scattered, and we were burning down the houses and chopping down the fruit trees and killing the animals. And we had blocks of poison to put down the wells. And we had a pump spray can for spraying poison on any rice that we found so it couldn't be eaten.
So if anyone ate that rice after it had been sprayed?
Oh, they'd die.
They would die.
The only thing we had a hard time destroying was we found a whole shed full of salt. Little balls of salt. You'd make a snowball. We couldn't figure out how to destroy salt, so we called an airstrike on it, which didn't do much.
Oh, Jesus.
On a shed full of salt. But anyway.
Now, so you said there were six or seven other guys. Do you remember who they were?
A couple of them probably, yeah. I mean, you shift. It's like we're moving through, and five or six guys will stop here, and then you kind of get back together and move and shift again, you know.
But the reactions of the guys, they were blasé about what was going on. So they had evidently seen this over and over, and it was blasé to them.
We had been killing hundreds of people a month that way, you know. So it was just, they didn't express any shock at it at all.
You know, surely in that whole unit, you know, some people would feel remorse or say, "What are we doing?" or something like that. And did that come up? And if it did, what happened to those guys?
Only one time, when the girl was being raped during the night, we had a new medic that had only been with us two or three days. And he objected to it. And he was beaten so badly they broke two of his ribs and put a .45 in his mouth and said, "If you say another word, we'll blow your damn head off." So, since this time, other people have come forward and said they didn't feel right about it. But I was the only one that actually complained about it. And people were risking their life if they complained about this. If they had refused to do something or complained, they could have been killed just right on the spot. There was an interview with the people at My Lai that committed the My Lai massacre on the 20-year anniversary. And I think it was Frontline did the interview. I'm not positive. I think it was Frontline. And when they interviewed the platoon sergeant, they said, "What if one of your men had refused to shoot those people?" He said, "I'd have killed him on the spot for being a coward."
Wow, that's really a mindset. That must have been going on quite a long time at all levels where people would accept it like that, I would think.
It definitely came from the top down, but it had been going on for, on a low level, it had been going on for quite a while, you know, one or two people here or there. But this
for
was
months?
Weeks, since I had been in country, that was about 7 months at that time, months at that time.
A lot of these atrocities that were committed by our guys were done out of fear for their own lives if they did not go along with the game, would you say?
Oh, yeah, if they didn't go along, yeah, fear from our people, not from the enemy. Yes,
right.
Oh, yeah. Well, if they didn't go along, see, in a unit like that where you depend on each other so much and in extreme conditions, you can be ostracized to death. You know, everyone is going to get diarrhea. Most people are going to get malaria. Things are going to go wrong, and you're going to need people to help you. You know, and you can be ostracized to death just by people not helping you, just by people not backing you up. And I don't mean just in fights. We used to say the hardest part of being there was living day to day, you know, not the firefights. Living in the jungle day to day with a bath once a month, maybe once every 45 days, have your clothes rot off, pick leeches off every morning, clean out your jungle rot every morning, you know, that sort of thing wears people down. When you clean your clothes by scraping them with a machete, when you carry people and you get blood on you, you have to wear it for the rest of the month. It's that sort of thing is what wears people down. And we used to say that was the hardest part, not the firefights. You know, the hardest part was living every day in the jungle and carrying a 70-pound load up a muddy mountain and getting so tired you feel like crying, you know, sliding and falling down, and the vines keep grabbing your pack and pulling you over backwards. And just that kind of thing is the hard part, you know?
Wouldn't you guys go back and have a stand down every now and then? In the Marine Corps, they didn't leave us out there more than a week at a time, and then we would go back to either your regimental area or something of that nature, and you'd change your clothes out and you read your mail, and you'd be with a much larger group of Marines, and then after about being there about a week, then you go back out in the bush again.
No, they couldn't have us
stayed out there a long time.
Well, they couldn't if a colonel or if a bird colonel had only 30 days there, he couldn't have us in the rear for 5 or 6 days. He had to have us out there getting his body count. We got cut down one time. We started the morning with 119 people. At the end of the day, we had 27 that could walk and only 8 that weren't wounded. We were given an overnight rest and then combined with the remains of C Company, which had been chewed up almost as badly, and sent back out because we couldn't be allowed to rest because they had to get us out in the field and get what they needed for their promotion. We had one colonel that came in, and since our infantry unit number was 1st Battalion 327th Infantry, to make a headline, to get a news story, he wanted 327 enemy killed during his month. And we got him 327 by the 19th of the month. 1st 327th Infantry. And he thought it would make a good news story and it would get him some publicity. So he wanted exactly 327 people killed.
What kind of morale did you have with the American troops? I mean, how did they feel over time? I mean, were they happy with what was going on, or were they a little distressed, or was anybody suicidal, or did people break out in fights, and what was going on with the morale there?
Well, people didn't break out in fights. We were really a close unit, you know, really, as platoon sergeant, you know, at one point, and twice I had to be platoon leader, because the officers would be killed or wounded. People were very close. They didn't care so much about their own life. Because your odds were real small of living through it anyway. But your friend's life was much more important. And so if we were hit from the front with an ambush, you have to send out flankers immediately. And the enemy knows you're going to flank, so they have people waiting for you. So you know if you send 3 people on the flank, usually at least one of them will get shot because they're coming up on people that are waiting for them. But if you're ordered to go on flank, like if I was ordered to go on flank, I would go knowing I might die, because if I didn't go, they would have to send other people that I just care so much about. And if they were to go in my place and die, the guilt would be too much for me to handle. So I would rather go than feel the guilt. And that's why people did things, because we just cared so much about each other. But people were just trying to live through the year, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to get through the year and get home. You know, I was being a partial medic one time, carrying a part of a kit bag, because our medic was dead, and one young guy died so hard, and he was holding on so tight. He wanted to get back to his girlfriend, and he just was holding on so much, and he finally died. It was just, people just wanted to live through it, and so they weren't fighting with each other. We didn't have any trouble between each other on the line.
No.
People were scrupulously honest with each other, and I think people were purely themselves. A few were purely monsters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but people were purely themselves, and I think that I miss that sometimes, of people not pretending. But they didn't complain. People occasionally got suicidal, but sometimes that expresses it. I was suicidal once and attacked a machine gun, and I was put in for a medal for it. I was being suicidal. So how do you tell? How do you tell when somebody's being suicidal? You know,
Dennis, let me ask you, the other day when we did this workshop, you were trying to convey the sense to which you knew officers up and down the line had to be aware of what was going on. Would you like...
Absolutely.
If I were a total stranger, didn't understand the structure of the Army, how would you convince me that...
Yeah, I was using that to relate to the current things in Iraq, in Abu Ghraib, and, you know, the most intimate relationship is probably between a platoon sergeant and his platoon. The next most intimate relationship in the Army is between a lieutenant and his platoon. The idea that a lieutenant would not know what his people are doing for 5 months is just beyond any belief at all. And the idea that a captain in charge of a company wouldn't come down to see what his people were up to is just completely beyond belief. You know, this any officer is responsible for the things that happen in his or her command, and there are no exceptions to that. They're absolutely responsible. And as in the case of a lieutenant or a captain, they know each of their people by name and their characteristics and what to expect of them in any situation, because they have to. And so the idea that officers wouldn't know what was going on with their people is just completely alien to anybody that's ever been in the military. That just is not possible. Would you agree with that?
I agree. I think it's impossible to do that. To me, I listen to your story, and I'm just amazed because, you know, my personal experience out there, I mean, we were in combat, we were getting shot up, but we were never left out there that long. You guys sound like you were just out there for months.
We went
and
once,
you get this
yeah.
whole. You get this whole, this is how it's done. This is this mm-hmm. is what we do out here. We shoot everybody or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was out there, we had, I was telling you about it before, we had an incident where I was, my first day basically in combat, and I didn't know what was going on. I'm a brand new lieutenant, and I was there to call in fire, so I just, you know, hung pretty tight with the command group. Well, so we set up our perimeter, and that night, you know, some Viet Cong came up from tunnels right in the middle of our position, and right in the middle of us, these people are walking around with guns. Well, a firefight goes out, and these people were killed. And, I mean, there's all kinds of chaos going on, but fortunately, we didn't take any casualties. But the next day, they had cut all the uniforms and any identifying stuff to send back to intelligence, and their bodies were naked. And there was a girl who was killed, a Viet Cong girl. And somebody had left a lit cigarette and put it in her privates there. And, it's, and I'm walking by, and there it is. And I go, for God's sake, you know. And I was kind of nervous. I didn't even know what a dead body looked like at that time. So, see, for God's sakes, I threw it on the ground, stepped on it. Then I went up to the captain, who I caught up with a few minutes later. I say, you have to bear with me, Skipper. Somebody put a cigarette in there. Now, is that the normal thing that we do out here? Is that do you do that as a sign of, contempt for the enemy, or it's a morale builder or something? And there was this big silence, and the captain looked at me, and the gunny's there, and everybody's looking at each other. And then the captain takes a deep breath, and he says, no, he says. And he says, gunny, go out there and take a squad and dig a big hole and put those bodies in that hole and cover it up. Mm-hmm. God damn it. And that was that. And so, but see, when you're a young guy going out there and you're naive, you're trying to fit in, right? And mm-hmm. you're trying to see, well, what is the norm that's going on here? And so that was his decision on this. And then after you're out in the field for about a week, you go back, it's fresh clothes, you read your mail, you see all these other people who are in the regimental area, you talk, you see your buddies, and you get back to normal a little bit. Then you go back out in the field later on for a week. And so, in contrast with your story, is these people are out there for months, and the norm is just to kill everybody, and to me, it's shocking.
It's a shocking story.
I can understand how it happens, though.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the norm, you're a young, naive guy, you think, well, that is the norm, that's the way we do things,
mm-hmm.
especially if the officers are telling it to you, too.
Oh, yeah. When we got new guys called cherries in, you know, they learned to do those things. You know, people don't start out just trying to skin someone. They start kicking them and hitting them and burning them with cigarettes, and they work their way up from there. But being the coldest, hardest person was the most admired thing. And it was most admired by the officers and everyone. But I've talked to some Marines. I wasn't in the Marines, but I've talked to them, and they had a much different way of treating things in our area anyway. I've talked to Marines that were in the Marine units nearby, and when one of their people unnecessarily killed a civilian, and I don't mean accidentally, that happens all the time, but a real out-and-out killing or a murder, they were called into their superior and chewed out and sometimes reduced in rank or have their pay docked, and they let it be known that that behavior would not be tolerated. So they had a much lower incident of this kind of stuff because their officers were enforcing the rules their own way. So in answer to yours, several things. One, we were told we would be guaranteed one hot meal per month, and one beer and one soda per man per month. And one time we were out for 45 days without a hot meal or anything. We were out 45 days continuously. And since we were a unit to get promotions, the official thing was if we went 5 days without significant enemy contact, we would be pulled out of that area and put into another one. And when we entered this area, the Songwei Valley, where most of these killings took place that I'm reporting, that was considered a free fire zone. And we hadn't been in a free fire zone before. And the colonel's instructions to us were we would move through the valley, He said, you will not allow anyone to move in front of you, any indigenous personnel to move in front of you, because they may warn the enemy you're coming. You will not allow them to pass through your lines, because they may dig up weapons and attack you from the rear. He said, you will not keep them with you, because it will slow your progress, and there will be no evacuation provided for indigenous personnel. Then he ended by saying, and when you leave this valley, there will be no living thing left in this valley.
That was the nature of free fire zones, though. Really, they weren't, the ones we saw, they told all the people, get out. Nobody's supposed to be here.
They had told the people to get out. Some of them had been taken to government compounds, and what they said was, when they got to the government compound, a single person was given an area 2 feet wide by 6 feet long, with no roof over it, and that was where they were supposed to be. A family was given an area 6 feet wide by 6 feet long, with no roof over it. And you had to pay a bribe to get under a roof. And they would go out and work in the rice fields, which were controlled by the government officers. And so they would escape from there and go home. And so a lot of them weren't picked up in the first sweep. Some had returned, but they were all considered. The colonel said they were a resource that the enemy could use to carry rice, grow food, dig positions, and we had to deprive the enemy of their resource. Now, there was heavy fighting around the valley in Quang Nai. We took tremendous casualties around in the mountains around the valley, but not right down in the valley where we were killing all the people. So this wasn't happening during combat. I mean, we took sniper fire and lightweight stuff down in the valley, but the really big fights we got into were in the surrounding area of Quang Nai. And this is the same valley where My Lai happened later, after we were finished there. The 11th Infantry did that. If they had come down really hard and landed with both boots on six people when I first turned this in 1967, I don't think My Lai or Lai K, which people don't know about, but was a mile or two away from My Lai, the same number of people killed approximately, and the Americans don't know about it because there were no photographs. But I don't think those things would have happened if the Army had landed really hard on just about six people in the chain of command. I think that would have put an end to this immediately.
So My Lai was not the first atrocity of that scale or the last. It was just the one that was discovered.
It was the one that there were photographs of. Because the Army, not me, but the Army that has done two investigations of my claims now, and the first investigation substantiated charges against 14 American soldiers for 18 war crimes. The reinvestigation that took place this year, early this year, substantiated charges against 18 Americans for 23 war crimes. So everything I have said has been fully substantiated by the Army. They have 11 sworn testimonies from soldiers who were there that back up the things that I say. And one of the war crimes that the Army is charging is that our unit killed at least 3,000 unarmed civilians in a five-month period.
And what is the status of this investigation today?
The CID has finished their portion, sent it up to the Secretary of the Army and the Secretary of Defense for a decision.
That would be Donald Rumsfeld.
Donald Rumsfeld. But the first investigation got as far as Donald Rumsfeld, and it was killed. It was killed on the same month that he became Defense Secretary under President Ford. He had been Deputy Defense Secretary under Nixon, and he became, in September, I think it was 10th or 12th, he became Defense Secretary.
What was their excuse for killing it back then?
They didn't even let it be known that they had done an investigation at that point. We didn't find out it had even been killed or investigated until the Toledo Blade spent 2 years researching this. I was told all this time, and I had my state senator Udall wrote a letter asking about this when I had all the press coverage in 1969. He was told I was totally uncooperative and would not give them any evidence, but they had gone and tried to investigate anyway, but the area was behind enemy lines and it couldn't be investigated. When in truth, they had sent five people down from the Pentagon to do this investigation. And they were doing a thorough investigation where they interviewed over 100 people in the unit. To show you one thing, I reported that rape and murder of the girl was committed by C Company. I reported that to the CID. They mistakenly investigated B Company. They found two similar incidents, one where a girl had been raped for 2 nights and killed, and one where a girl had been raped overnight and killed, by investigating the wrong company. And when I was re-interviewed by them for 5 hours I said, doesn't that indicate that this wasn't just an isolated incident, a few rogue soldiers, you know? Anyway, my two state representatives wrote letters for me. They were told there was no investigation. And then the Toledo Blade, I didn't know they were doing this, but they did 2 years' worth of research on this, including flying to Vietnam and interviewing some of the survivors. What I hear, and it's in their articles, is they were given a box of documents by a colonel who was dying, had a terminal cancer or something, classified documents. And they checked those out, and they kept running into references to the Stout investigation. So they didn't know who that was. And when they started, after their 2 years, they started to print the stories. A sister of a lady friend of mine lives in Toledo, and she said, you know those stories that Dennis tell? They're in our newspaper. So I emailed the Toledo Blade and said, my name's Dennis Stout. I understand you're doing a series on war crimes with the Tiger Force and the 1st 327th Infantry. And immediately, they emailed me back and said, you're the one. We've been looking for you. And they uncovered 176 pages of my original testimony to the CID from the National Archives. And I had been putting in requests under the Freedom of Information Act, and they had been denying anything existed because I had said I wanted anything under war crimes and Dennis Stout. And they said there was nothing there because they had it under Stout investigation. I put another one in that said war crimes and the 1st 327th Infantry Battalion. They didn't return it. They said there was nothing there because they had it under 1st 327th INF period, BN period. So it turned out, and Randall Doyle, not the Doyle mentioned in the story, but an investigator for the CID called Randall Doyle, was the in the second line of it. He wasn't the chief investigator, but he was the one who actually went out and did all the second investigation. He said they found over 3 feet worth of records from this original investigation. It was very thoroughly investigated and documented.
Did the you were mentioning photographs too earlier? You know, did the photographs show up in the records as well?
I don't know of any photographs. No, we don't have access to that 3 feet. We wish we did.
But you were personally taking photographs during this time. What happened to those photographs?
Okay, first of all, I didn't have access to film, but the Army would issue me like 5 rolls at a time. I had to turn 5 rolls in. And I did take a couple personal. I had a half-frame Olympus Pen camera, and I took several rolls of film. But when I turned those in, the photo lab sent a thing forward saying that they were all ruined by moisture. But I found out later that they were selling them to them so they could put them in their photo albums and show that they were combat soldiers.
Dennis, let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You've told me in previous conversations about your attempts to get copies of these records.
Oh, yes.
And I know you succeeded this early in the spring to get, 125 pages of documents, and that took a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. What do they say to your request to get other documents from this file?
Well, they say, well, now that they found out they were getting through the National Archives, they reclassified those. So they can't get any more from the National Archives. And they say it still is under investigation, therefore they can't release any records about that they've uncovered.
And what happened to the other photographs that you took with the film that was provided to you by the Army?
I turned it into the Army lab. But any photograph had to be censored by 5 censors. Anything I wrote or any photographs had to go through 5 censors before it could be printed. So nothing much came out. They disappeared.
You never saw any of them printed?
Oh, yes, but not... Oh, yes, I was on UPI, AP and UPI Wire, and I got my name, you know, credited to the photos, but they were all pretty much... And some had been recaptioned. I tried to show how the M16 wasn't firing, and half of our people couldn't fire in combat. And I took a picture of the paratroopers in a dry irrigation ditch, with some guys firing and some guys crouched down waiting for a cleaning rod, because we only got 1 cleaning rod for every 4 weapons. And you can only clear it with a cleaning rod because the cartridge jams in the chamber, so everyone would call for a cleaning rod and they'd have to be passed down and clear the weapon. And so they're crouched down waiting for a cleaning rod. And I was able to slug my photos, put what I thought they should say, and then the editors would change it. And I slugged it with, here in actual combat, half of the M16s jam, you know, during a firefight. And you could even see incoming fire kicking up dust in front of one of the guys who was shooting. So And it was right during a firefight. And they recaptioned it. Here in combat, paratroopers put into action what they learned in training about one man firing while the other is reloading.
Oh.
And I took a picture of a medic who had run out into... We were rarely near rice paddies, but one time we were near flooded paddies, and he ran out to grab a wounded man, and he picked up the guy's M16 and grabbed him by the collar and was dragging him back toward us. And I caught the photo right when two bullets that were being fired at him had kicked up fountains of water next to him, and I thought that was a great photo. They refused to publish it because it said medics don't carry weapons. So it could be censored for anything. Most of my pictures that got published were just a guy firing an M79 with, you know, no background, or troops moving through rice paddies, or, you know, things that were very bland.
That's no, the only no contact type stuff.
No, nothing like that.
You know, a little footnote to today in Jessica Lynch's write-up of what happened to her, you know, when her convoy was attacked in Iraq. She says she had an M16, and she locked and loaded and went to fire, and it jammed. And she says, oh, my God, and she fell down on the bottom of the cab, and, and that was it for her. And same rifle, different war, you know, 40 years later, jam in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Well, this another thing I wanted to get into was the continuing cover-up of this, because Senator McCain and Dennis Kucinich have been helping me in this recent reinvestigation, trying to get information. The first two letters that John McCain wrote for me, the Army lied to him straight out by telling him there were no records and there was no investigation. So when I had the things from the Toledo Blade and I took in some of the investigation to his aide, I'm assuming she showed it to the senator. She said he was so mad he was ready to go out and bite someone. So
we have the United States Army lying to a United States senator.
Yes. In fact, if you watched, I think it was CNN, when during the Abu Ghraib hearings, Senator McCain was questioning Donald Rumsfeld and his two aides. And Senator McCain asked Donald Rumsfeld for the chain of command of the people who had been in charge of the prison. And Donald Rumsfeld says, oh, darn, we had that for you back at the office and we forgot to bring it with us. And so John McCain said, do you or your aides have a cell phone? And Donald Rumsfeld kind of just didn't answer. He started talking on, and McCain said, do you or your aides have a cell phone? And one of the generals said, well, yes, I do. He said, call your office and have it walked over here. It's a 10-minute walk. So time goes by, and pretty soon he says to the general, he said, do you have the chain of command for me now? And he said, no, I don't. And he said, are you going to give it to me? And he said, no, we're not. He said, why not? And he said, because we don't have to. And I related that to his aide. I have her card here. And she said, yes, isn't that funny? Her name's Christina Guthrie. She said, wasn't that funny? And I said, no, you know, in other countries, when the military refuses to respond to civilian leadership, we call it a coup. Anyway, he's getting no answers now when he sends things in. And I don't know what the status of Dennis Kucinich. He's been very helpful. And I need to catch up with him here at the convention and find out what's going on with his. I've been dealing with his aide, Jaron Bork. They've been very helpful. But so far, they're being stonewalled by the military on this. And the three reporters, Mike Sala, Mitch Weiss, and Joe Marr of the Toledo Blade, have won the Pulitzer Prize for this series. And if anybody wants to read this, they should go to ToledoBlade.com, and it's under the heading of Buried Secrets and Brutal Truths. So I think it's a 13 or 15-part series where all of this is printed. They won the Pulitzer for this, so it has been extensively fact-checked in the light of, you know, past Pulitzer scandals. It's been extensively fact-checked, and they tell me they have sworn affidavits also from previous members of the unit as to what happened. So in February, I think early March, I was re-interviewed by the CID, and I had some pages of my original investigation. When they sat down, I asked them, do you have any of my original investigation? They said, no, it's completely disappeared. We can't find it at all. I said, well, I have copies here for you. And so I pulled them out and gave them to them, where I had highlighted all the things that backed up what I said and more. And they were very fascinated by it, because every time a fact comes up in a CID investigation, when it's printed out, every time a fact comes up that is corroborated by other testimony, these numbers appear, which are reference numbers to the other investigation. And some of the facts had as many as 3 reference numbers where the same thing was corroborated by something else. So within that body of things, there were over 100 cross-references to other parts of the investigation. So I gave each of them a copy, and I still retain a copy of it also. So they were quite amazed by that. And they said, though, they were going to only re-interview 3 people. Myself and a former medic from the Tiger Force named Ryan Causey, and the original lead investigator of the first investigation. And I said, well, you know, Colonel, there's a colonel from our group that lives right outside of Phoenix here in Sun Lakes. Aren't you going to talk to him? And they said, no, we think the interview we did with him in 1969 is sufficient. So, yeah, how this stuff, I wanted to say how this stuff relates today, because people can write this all off as happening then, but you know from the things that we're learning about the prison, and the prison thing at Abu Ghraib, that this sort of thing is still going on today. And it always starts from the top down. It can't just be 6 enlisted people doing this without anybody knowing, for the reasons I cited earlier. In this thing with Abu Ghraib, there's been many more things happen. In yesterday's Boston Globe, it was saying that 49 prisoners have been killed in custody by processes including boarding, which is a medieval thing of strapping someone onto a board and dunking them underwater till they feel like they're going to drown in order to question them, and then they've accidentally drowned them, by standing on their chest to keep them from breathing, and from stepping on their neck and crushing their larynx. And in some cases, they've been jumped on and their rib cage broken, and then by slamming them into walls and things. But there aren't any photos of that, so people focus on this pseudo-sexual stuff, not realizing we've already killed 49 people in custody that were not convicted of anything.
Abu Ghraib is certainly not the only detention center at the present time. So in your opinion, would you say that these things are most likely going on in the other detention centers as well?
Of course. Just like the types of things I'm reporting as war crimes were going on in, not everywhere in Vietnam, but a lot of other places in Vietnam and a lot of other units. I've heard from other vets that say, well, we did that in our unit all the time. So it's like, I know this stuff was going on, but only the photos of My Lai triggered this, you know, and the photos of Abu Ghraib. There should be some method to trigger an investigation, some mechanism besides the shutter of a camera. There should be something that gets this taken care of. All it takes, right now, by talking to the CID people, I asked what punishments could be done if they don't try them for war crimes. They said, well, if we substantiate this, some of the people who have retired now, maybe at general rank or bird colonel rank, they can, if they're reduced in grade, you know, then instead of being a bird colonel, they're reduced to light colonel or lieutenant colonel. We always tease them by saying light colonel, but it's lieutenant colonel. If they're reduced from full colonel to lieutenant colonel, they would have to refund that portion of their pay from back at the time the crime was committed until today, including their retirement. And if they did that to just 1 or 2 people now, it would send a shockwave through the Army hierarchy, and no officer would want this stuff committed in his unit because it would threaten his retirement.
Okay, Dennis, let me ask you another question. In terms of war crimes, you know, recently, I picked up a news story saying that the folks that investigate Holocaust crimes during World War II against Jews in Europe had determined that they're still going to continue to try to hunt down guards or whatever in some of the concentration camps back to World War II, where some of these guards are in their 80s, maybe 90s. That is still considered a legitimate attempt to bring justice this far after the fact.
Well, as you said, there's no statute of limitations on war crimes. You know, you can hunt people forever. They're hunting someone now that's in his 90s that was a camp guard. They don't even think he killed anybody, but he was a camp guard. And
in World War II.
In World War II. And after World War II, we convicted a general, I think his name was Yamashita, a Japanese general, for crimes committed by his troops in the Philippines, even though it was proven he never was there. And he had given them written orders not to do those things. But we hung him because we claimed he should have had enough control of his troops to prevent that. So, and that was a U.S. Supreme Court decision, not a military court decision. So under the Yamashita rule, I think there's a whole lot of people, including General Westmoreland, that would have to give pause to that. There's been a former North Vietnamese colonel named Nguyen Thai. His old responsibility was helping find their missing in action. He's now been put in charge of examination of these war crimes on the Vietnamese end of this. The Vietnamese government right now does not want trouble with the U.S. government, so they're not pushing for prosecution. But the guys at the Toledo Blade tell me they get emails all the time from the people of Vietnam saying, don't drop this story. Keep pushing. You know, we want justice. We want this done. And I've been told that perhaps this can be pursued in civil court for damages. And for myself, the CID people said I'm the last living, I'm the only living witness to five of these eight war crimes that I reported that's come forward. So I want to get this stuff archived in case I die. So I'm trying to get all this collected from what the Toledo Blade has and the stuff I have, everything I can get, and send one copy to Nguyen Thai to be put in their Museum of Atrocities, which is being rebuilt right now. And I want to take the other copy to Europe and file it with the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, even though they don't currently have jurisdiction in this, because the United States has exempted itself from any prosecutions for war crimes. And the president issued an order about a month and a half ago that the U.S. military can use any means necessary to free an American being held for war crimes and return him to this country. So I want to file it with the court as an archival thing. I want them to preserve this for future use. As you said, there is no statute of limitations on war crimes. And if at some time in the future they want to bring Westmoreland or any of these other people to trial, I want them to have this information on file. So I'm going to ask them to accept it as an archival function of the court and see what can be done with it later.
Let me ask you a question. I talk to high school classes a lot, and I explain to them that I served in Vietnam as a civilian and, you know, worked with civilian Vietnamese. That was my job. But it seems to me that if it becomes widely known that the United States itself does not respect the Geneva Conventions and the rules of war, that in fact would place our own men in greater jeopardy in case they get captured in combat. Now, you three guys were military people in combat. Would you agree that if you were young again and in combat and you felt the enemy widely knows that you don't respect the rules of war, would you expect fair, decent treatment if you were captured and that they would be willing to live up to the Geneva Conventions in regard to prisoners of war?
No, not at all. Because if we don't respect it, we can't expect anyone else to respect it. You know, either you have a rule or you don't. If you have a rule, you enforce it, you know? If there's no rule, then we're the same as any army, Genghis Khan, Alexander the Great. You know, there were no war crimes then because you could do anything to anyone. And if we're going to be that type of army, well, then that's it is. But, you know, these war crime things that we enforce are only enforced when white people are killed. There's no enforcement when Asian people are killed or black people are killed. It's only when white people are killed that we start calling for war crimes enforcement. So, you know, there must be a racist contingent to this, too. You know, why is a life of a European worth more than the lives of 3,000, people in Vietnam? And what makes a war crime? You know, the convention says a crime against one person is a war crime. You don't have to have a huge number, you know? People say, well, they killed 3,000 of our people, in 9-1-1. Okay, we killed 3,000 of them. It took us 5 months, but we killed 3,000 of them. The suffering is not objective, it's subjective. And that's why the law was written that each person that is a crime is committed against, that is a war crime even if it's only one person. So it can't be explained away, you know, by this only happened in a few isolated places or a few rogue soldiers. Well, if it's a few rogue soldiers, then you take those rogue soldiers and you try them. And you make an example of them so other rogue soldiers don't get out of control.
You know, since you asked, you know, about how do I feel on it, I think probably one of the greater crimes that's going on here is that you know, we are corrupting our soldiers and making them feel that this is perfectly okay to be doing these kind of atrocities. And we're saying, no, this is the norm. This is how you do it. And so they have this profound atrocity that goes against human nature entirely. And they're saying, this is normal. So these kids go do this. They lay waste to the general population out there, and then they go home. Mm-hmm. Now, I think I would rather have died out there than to go home and keep this burden of all these people and all these atrocities, and then to go home and try to live with that, you know. And the greater crime I see, I see it going on today. I mean, the only ones they give a bad time to, the only ones that they in this Abu Ghraib prison scandal, it's about seven different junior enlisted people are the ones they're hanging. Yet, you know, you can see that it's the same sort of deal going on in those prisons as went on over there in your area. You know, all the officers are in on it, and they're being told from on top how to do it. And when the shit hits the fan, it's these young enlisted guys who do it, and they carry the burden. And the rest of them go home and retire and put their medals on, have a great time. And it's covered up by the higher ups like Rumsfeld and the government. And the military is strictly cannon fodder in this, and their lives are ruined. Their lives are more ruined than all the people they killed.
Yeah, most
that's the atrocity here, I think.
Yeah, our veterans group in the 80s had an outreach thing for homeless veterans. And a lot of the guys under the bridges drinking out of paper bags had been the guys who became monsters. I'm so glad I didn't participate in these things, but at the time I felt very out of place. You know, I felt very odd not to be doing this. If you think of it, the training that we had selects for sociopaths. You know, sociopathic people that have no feeling for anyone else's suffering are praised, and our unit was such a wonderful paradise for them because they could kill and torture and get medals for it. I have a picture of Sergeant Doyle getting a medal for killing a lot of people, and they were civilians, and he even admits they were civilians. Ibarra, the guy who claimed to have killed 1,000 people, got an award for that. And I don't think he really killed 1,000 people, but he did grab a baby away from the mother and chop its head off to get its necklace. Now, this kind of stuff was praised. He was the hardest, coldest, he was the best torturer. That's the kind of thing that got praised. So sociopaths had a home. You know, I think that, I'm just guessing, I'm making these numbers up, but maybe 4 or 5% of the people that get in these units, unless it's specially selected like ours, are sociopaths and will kill with very little provocation. And 4 or 5% will not do these things even on pain of death, you know? And the ones in between can be convinced. You know, they can be convinced to go along with this by the command structure, the reward system. But what they get out of it is guilt. Like you said, the guilt. That's the burden. I didn't do these things, but I had my own ball of guilt to get rid of. And the hardest thing I've ever done in my life was to forgive myself. That is so hard. These guys became monsters. Some of them were in that 90% in between, who wouldn't have been monsters otherwise. They're the ones that feel the guilt. They have so much guilt that they cannot, I call it, unmonster themselves. Even if the Vietnamese were to forgive them, even if everyone else forgives them, they can't let it go themselves, because guilt is never satisfied. The more you feed it, the more it wants. And you can never take praise, you can never take pride, because you always know of what you did. And it always seems hollow. You can never take pleasure in things and accomplishments, because this guilt, it's inside of you like a cold chunk of concrete that doesn't let any warmth come out. So to take on that guilt, I think, destroys the rest of their life.
How would you relate that to today in Iraq, and the 18, 19, 20-year-old kids over there who are being exposed to what I'm assuming is a similar kind of situation, where you have a normal, quote-unquote, normal person placed in an abnormal situation where they may have a few of these sociopaths in their platoon. What can we expect to happen to our sons and daughters today?
Well, they're going to come back with a lot of the symptoms that the guys from Vietnam came back with. The men and women that come, and I always say our beautiful soldiers that come back now, are also going to be damaged. When they go in, if you watch the movie Fahrenheit 911, they show the guys going in and they're really hardcore and they're killing everybody. And then the guy says, and then we started looking at him and I saw a guy carrying his dead wife, and then I saw a dead child. It's like, when they realize what they're doing, they're going to be damaged just like everyone else. And the damage takes years to show up. So I think that's going to happen. You know, there's a quotation from the beginning in the front of the All Quiet on the Western Front, written about World War One. I'll have to paraphrase it because I usually carry it with me, but I don't have it today. But it says, "This book is dedicated to those who face death, not because of heroism and things, but it's dedicated to them because to the men who survived the bombs and shells of the war, but whose lives were ruined." And if you read that quotation from All Quiet on the Western Front, it perfectly describes the people from Vietnam. And I think it will, in the end, perfectly describe the people from this war. Another war where you win nothing. People fighting now should realize that they're fighting, and if they die, it is for nothing. It has defended nothing. You know, in Vietnam, any intelligent person that was there more than a month in our unit gave up the hope of living through it. I mean, you just do the odds. You know? It's not much chance you're going to make it through. And also, you would realize very quickly that it was for absolutely nothing. You know, your blood would go out of you and into the mud and for nothing. You know, so I think these people in Iraq are going to be even more damaged than from other wars because they're fighting for zero. And anyone who dies and suffering, the suffering that goes on. You know, if a new person came in and they were killed in the first week or two, we didn't feel sorry for them at all. Not just because we didn't know them, but they hadn't had to suffer. People who had to suffer through most of a year carrying those loads and living the way we lived and just having all these terrible things and walking with fevers and walking when you're so weak from diarrhea you can hardly put one foot in front of the other, going through this day-to-day torture and then be killed, that was a tragedy. You know, so these people will have the same thing. They're there a year, they get extended another 4 months. We had a guy that would have been out of the country. He had only, I think, 6 days left in country, and 8 days before you leave, you're supposed to be sent back. I think he had nine, maybe one day more than he's supposed to. And we got resupplied every 7 days. So he wanted to get out. But the captain wouldn't let him go because he wasn't at 8 days. He wanted to hold on to him for that extra 7 days. And we were hit really badly, and he was hit with a bullet that hit him in one hip bone and shattered it, and it went up through his intestines, and he was bleeding out slowly. And there's no way we could stop the bleeding. It had nicked some artery or something in there. And he was bleeding out slowly, but he was still conscious, and he knew he was dying. And the captain came walking by because the captain's hand had been chopped off by a mortar fragment. And so the captain had his arm all in a bandage, and he was walking down the line of wounded saying, "How's it going, soldier?" And things. He came to this guy, and he said, "How's it going, soldier?" And the guy said, "You killed me, you motherfucker." Because he really had. He'd kept him in there. What about these guys that finish their year, and they're extended 2 months, and then they die in that 2 months, you know? They did their part. They did what they agreed to, and the Army extended them a little bit more. The Marine Corps extended them a little bit more with a stop loss, and then they get killed, you know? There's going to be so much to recover, and Veterans for Peace is going to be here to help those people when they get back. We're starting a youth chapter, a young guy chapter, because we need some young guys to replace us old guys. But they need people like us when they come back that can say, "Look, you can survive this, you know? You don't have to become an alcoholic. We can help you, you know?"
Let me just tell a story. A few weeks ago before this convention, I was contacted by a friend who had been contacted by a father of a Marine living out in Belchertown, Massachusetts. And this man called us up because he saw the Veterans Education Project in the phone book and had to reach somebody. His son had just committed suicide. The story was his son had served in Iraq with the Marines for I don't know how long. He'd just gotten home about 6 months ago. He was in a position, he was a reservist, but he was on notice that he could be sent back to Iraq. The whole 6 months he'd been home, he went through classic PTSD symptoms, and recent studies show that maybe 15 to 20% of returning troops from Iraq now are showing PTSD symptoms.
Which is soon post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right, as soon as they get back, which is a much higher incidence of immediate symptoms than I believe ever happened in Vietnam. In any event, the parents of this guy tried to get him treatment with the VA. They took him to the VA, local VA hospital in Northampton, Massachusetts on Memorial Day. They were crowded, busy. They sent him home. They said, "No, it's nothing much we can do for him." A week later, they tried to get him back and commit him because he was showing suicidal symptoms. They tried to commit him at the VA hospital. At that point, the young man was getting angry with his parents for trying to commit him in a mental institution, didn't want to be committed, got out of it. And then a week or so after that, the dad went down to the basement and saw the young man hanging. He'd hung himself to death. Now this, the parent, the dad, had called us. He said, you know, there's nothing he can do to save his son at this point, but he's very angry that the VA hospital and prior to that, the Marine medical system, had done nothing really to deal with his son's problems. And wanted to know, you know, and my feeling is here we are, veterans groups, we try to, you know, we do the political work. Well, now I think it's time to try to see if we can't bring the resources to bear so that we can help families like this. Because the military's own studies show that there are large numbers of people coming back in the system fit with these symptoms. And many of these people are still in a position where they could be turned around and sent back to Iraq.
You know, you don't have to go see 9/11 to hear these stories.
Oh, no.
I mean, I live in Oceanside near Camp Pendleton, and I talk to the troops there, you know, because, hey, I'm a Marine. I wear a Marine Corps emblem on my Vets for Peace hat. So they talk to me. And, you know, the story I hear the most common from those young guys is that they're killing civilians. You know, and they say, you know, I mean, this is what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to stop, and if they don't stop, we're supposed to take the car out. And that's our orders, and we're doing it to protect ourselves. But virtually every car we blow away is filled with civilians. It's kids and families and stuff. But that's what we had to do. It could have been a car bomb. I mean, and those things happen. The car bomb guys do get through, and they blow up and kill a lot of Marines, or they get in, they blow up a police station, and your job is to stop. But virtually the vast majority of ones we stop are full of civilians, and we blew them all away.
I heard an interesting story from the woman yesterday, from the vest, just as a note. The hand gesture that we use to signal someone to stop, which is to hold your hand up with palm out like a traffic officer would do if he was indicating stop, means hello to the Iraqis.
That's
the sign they use to say hello to one another. And they haven't even told the troops that are over there that this gesture means hello to the Iraqis. So they're approaching a checkpoint and we're saying hello to them, and when they don't stop, we blow them away.
Yeah, I've already had a Marine second lieutenant tell me that when they were in the invasion and they took a bridge on the Euphrates, they were told to shoot any vehicle that came across the bridge, and some guys were supposed to go down and put up barriers to keep vehicles from coming onto the bridge. Well, they started down that way and got diverted by another officer that ordered them to do something else. So they were shooting every car that came up across the bridge and just tearing them up with the cannon fire and things. And they didn't find any armed person in any of the five vehicles that they blew apart. It was all civilians trying to get away from the fighting.
Jim, I interrupted you there. I'm sorry. Did you want to finish?
There was another point that Chris made about these guys come home and they're dripping in PTSD. You can see the symptoms. And one of them was referred to us, and he was actually cutting himself on the arms.
Oh, yeah.
And so he says, well, I went in and told my story to the corpsman, you know, in my battalion. And the corpsman says, man, you need to go see the psych. So you go up and see the psychological officer, who is a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And she listened to the story, and she cried her eyes out when she heard the story. She says, listen, you come back tomorrow, you know, and I'll take care of this. So he goes in there the next day, and there's a new psych officer, some male guy. He says, hey, suck it up, Marine. He says, for God's sakes, you're no different than anybody else. And quit cutting yourself. What the hell do you think you're doing? You know, just suck it up, and you'll be all right. Don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the Marine says, yes, sir. Yeah. He turns around, he marches out, and then he said, fuck it. He says, I'm out of here. But he did contact us. He was ready to just to go to Canada, take his wife and kids, drive off, never come back, he says. And we said, well, that's one option, he says, to do that. But, you know, you could also, and we found out because one of our local peace group people is a psychologist. She says, that boy needs to go over and see a civilian psychiatrist and tell the story, and he'll easily be identified as PTSD, and the psychiatrist will give him will put him on medication, which will stop this deployment 100%. as long as he's on this medicine. So everything is great. The guy only had 6 months left to go on his deployment, and he got on this medicine, and we say, well, this is great. He'll get out. He'll have an honorable discharge, and he won't kill himself. So what just happened just last week, they're going to deploy him again. The psychiatrist at the base says, no, you're okay now. He says, you've had your medicine. You're not showing the symptoms, and says, go into some training here, and you're leaving in 2 months. And I'll be surprised that young Marine is alive when I get home.
Yeah, with our unit, they didn't want to admit that the Vietnam War was unpopular with the troops, so no one could have mental problems. I mean, we had some pretty crazy people, but nobody could have mental problems. We had one guy, his nickname was Hard Rock, and he would finish a fight, and then he would roll up in a ball and not communicate with anybody. So instead of sending him to a psychiatric ward, we couldn't do that, but we got him into what they called the mental health area, which they would send him back to, I think it was Phan Rang, and they had a chain-link fenced area near the beach, but they had no access to the beach, but just out in the sand. And they saw a psychiatrist for half an hour when they came in, and then they were put in pup tents with sea rations, and they were given 3 little cups of water a day. And after 2 weeks of that, with no books, no anything, no nothing, after 2 weeks of that, they saw the psychiatrist again, and the psychiatrist would say, are you ready to go back to your unit, or do you want to spend another 2 weeks here?
In the tent.
And so they would return him. Jeez. We sent him twice, because he was useless to us, you know, and we sent him down twice. And finally, I wasn't with him that morning, but we got grazing fire. We got grazing machine gun fire, enemy machine gun fire, just a few inches off the ground, and everyone was laying really flat. And the guys next to him said, he just said, oh, fuck it. And he stood up and just got himself ripped to pieces. So they didn't want to admit that people were having trouble with it because that would reflect badly on the war. So you couldn't have a bunch of guys with psychiatric problems because, of course, they believed in the war.
No, and it's a hypocritical program. Most of the services say, oh, no, we are identifying these men who are coming home from Iraq, and we have programs for them. We talk to them. We have the officers available for them, But my own story shows how hypocritical that is in the case that I saw. I mean, it's a sham. And it's only through the intervention of outside psychiatric help is that guy is still alive.
And anyone who goes to a psychiatrist, that is the end of their career. That goes into their file, and they will never get a promotion again. Mm-hmm. So anyone who intends to make it a career can't even go into the mental health clinic for a visit. Because their paper will be made out, it'll go in their file, and that's the end of their career.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it's counterproductive in a combat zone anyhow to have a nutcase out there, somebody who's mentally unbalanced. That, you know, he's not going to do anything. He's going to kill people around him by screaming and yelling and acting crazy. We had a corpsman, you know, starts whimpering one night. We're out in combat. We're expecting contact. We've got our position all set up. And the corpsman starts whimpering. He won't shut up. You could hear him, you know. I said, "Sergeant, tell that guy to shut up," you know. And this is back in Vietnam in '69, and he was so loud you could hear the guy, you know. And he wouldn't shut up. So bring more. I said, "What is your problem? Can't you just shut up?" He said, "I'm so scared, sir." He says, "I'm just so scared. I just can't stop." You know. I say, "Well, if you don't stop, you're going to kill us all." You know. So, what do we have to do to have you shut up? He says, "I'll get it under control. I will." Goes back there 5 minutes later. You know, so I told the sergeant, just go over there and figure something out. Well, you had to shut him up. Don't shoot him or something, but, you know, do whatever you, and if you're worried about it, talk to me. So they gave him the morphine. They took the morphine out of his bag, and they knocked him out.
Yeah, we had some guys with us that should never be out there, some from wounds. We had one guy who was hit on when we were mortared really badly on Mother's Day. We called it Mother's Day Hill. He was hit behind the ear with fragments that went up in his brain. They couldn't take them out. And they sent him back to us. They had one of those officers come through the hospital like Patton, ordering everybody out to the line. And he would have a seizure about every 3 days. He had this terrible, violent seizure, and he would lose his memory and not remember anything for either a couple of hours or 10 or 12 hours. And then he would get his memory back. Mm-hmm. And one of his eyes didn't work because of the fragments had gone up into the front part of his brain, so one eye didn't work. And they sent him back to us, and they sent a guy back that had a punji stick into his thigh, and it had gotten infected, and they had to remove all the skin. So when he tried to step, his muscle would bulge way out, but his leg wouldn't work, so he had to put a towel over it and use pack straps to hold his leg together for 7 days until we could send him back. And we had one guy they sent out to us, you know, McNamara, they had McNamara's 100,000, who were people who were slightly retarded, that they said they could serve and they'd never go into combat. Well, the thing to do in the rear was, if somebody screwed up, was to send him out into combat as punishment. And we didn't need those guys.
No thanks.
We don't want those guys.
No thanks.
But he was retarded. It wasn't his fault. But they sent him out to us, and he was almost okay, but he couldn't link up things. If you said, you go around this way and I'll go around that way, he didn't get the connection between things. And he was a danger to us.
Yes.
And we sent him back once, and they made him a cook's helper. But he screwed up in the kitchen, so they sent him back to us as punishment. So we sent him back again, and they put him in the supply tent. And he screwed up there, so they sent him back to us, so we couldn't figure out what to do with him. And we did one of the best things we did the whole year. We arranged to shoot him, but in a nice way. We said, we'd just gone through a bunker complex and cleared it, so we said, okay, everybody get online. We're going to pretend we're clearing this, and when we hit this one online with this one log, we'll all stop, and he won't know that, so he'll step forward. And we put a guy down at the end with a jacketed 30 caliber round to shoot him in the leg. And it worked perfectly, and the medic was right behind him, ready to pounce on him. And we hit that log. We stopped. He stepped forward. The guy shot him through the thigh, just barely nicked the bone. The medic jumped on him, bandaged him, and we called a helicopter, because we'd had a place cut already from our wounded the day before. And we got him out, and we gave him the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart.
Big hero.
We got him out
of
there.
Going home, man. You're going home.
And we thought that was one of the best things we did in the whole year.
Well,
you know?
You saved his life, and you saved your life.
I know.
I'm a roofer, so I was fixing the roof on the house of this young Marine staff sergeant getting promoted to gunny, and he had just come back, and he was special ops. These are the highly trained guys, big time. And they had all the gear. They had all the cool rifles. They had the flak jackets, all the inserts. Everybody in the squad had them, and they did everything out there. And he sized it all up, I thought. He says, we had all that stuff, but all the other troops out there that we would go through and we would see, you know, they would give the point man the stuff. Everybody would pass up the inserts and give it to the point guy, the guy up front who's leading the way. And they would change the point man, but they'd always make sure he had plenty. And then the rest would have one or nothing or something, and they'd be hoping that the body of the guy in front of them would shield them.
Talking about the bulletproof plates.
The plates they put inside the flak jackets,
but,
yeah.
You know, sizing up our whole conversation, Jim says, it's all about money. That whole war is all about money.
Yeah.
Money and numbers. He says, we're not doing anything out there. Most of the people we're killing are civilians, and it's all about money.
Yeah, my nephew does helicopter maintenance for the Marines. And he was first there, I think, only 5 months or 6 months. But they only had 3 working helicopters when their unit came back because they couldn't get replacement parts from the civilian supplier. So now he's back, and he's leaving in about 3 weeks to go back again, be redeployed. And they've got all the helicopters up, and he has 14 new people in his unit. And they're trying to pack as many parts with them this time as they can, because they were told last time that if something broke, they would be there to fix it. And they're packing as many spare parts in as they can so they can keep the helicopters flying this time.
The young Marine who's cutting himself and, you know, he's going crazy and stuff like that, his job is a driver, a truck driver, mm-hmm. who drives Humvees and trucks, which is the most dangerous position you can have in Iraq. And I say, so you went to Iraq, right? And then you came back, and why, when you're back getting ready to play again in another 7 months, what did you do? Did you get your jackets and get the new jackets and then put armor stuff on the sides? And he says, oh, no. I say, what do you mean, no? Haven't they done anything to your trucks? He says, nothing. He says, nothing at all.
Yeah, they'd been patching the bodies of the helicopter with beer can. And when he got back, they got the real aluminum. They were able to actually patch him with the right stuff now. Mm-hmm. But he said, and my other, the husband of my niece, is a truck driver. And he's a truck driver here. He's in the reserves, Marine Reserves. Mm-hmm. And he already did one tour driving trucks of gasoline from Kuwait up to Baghdad. But he said he never got shot at. It was the people in front or the people in back. But he never got shot at the whole time. He's going back also they told him in about 6 months he's going back again mm-hmm. to drive trucks again. So they don't get out of it like we did in a year. You know, I mean, you had 13 months in the Marines. We had a year. I got out 8 days short of my year. But they finish, and they're not. It's not finished.
No.
It's really terrible to see this all repeated over again for us, you know, to see the same thing going on. No lessons learned. People going around trying to claim that their Americans didn't commit any atrocities in Vietnam and trying to clean up history in order to justify what's going on now. And that is just sad. It's sad to the point that I just feel like sometimes I'm start crying because I'm filled up with tears, you know. It is just... to see all those beautiful soldiers going off and being killed and wounded again for nothing is just almost more than I can bear sometimes.
It's not a good thing to see the exact same trends, you know, the cover-up at the top and setting the wrong tone and our kids dying for nothing. And then they prosecute the young guys, you know.
And then not taking care of them when they get home.
And that's
the VA hospital. My VA hospital in Phoenix has had a 30% budget cut. And these new guys don't realize that when they signed their agreement, they now have to pay 15% of any treatment at the VA. They don't understand. One of my customer's wife is one of the admissions people for Arizona State. And she said these kids come in after finishing their 5 years in the military thinking they've earned an education. And she has to tell them, no, I'm sorry, you'll have to come up with $1,500 per semester. Because it doesn't cover a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. And she has to walk them down the hall to the loan officer when they thought they had earned an education. That's why they joined. Because they needed the job and they needed the education. How are they, in that financial situation, going to come up with $3,000? You know, a loan. Well, a loan makes interest for the loan company. It's like, what kind of benefit is that, you know?
Well, it is. The trouble is they abuse the sincerity of the young people, thinking that their president is all telling the truth and they're serving their country and everything will work out. And I was a young officer. I should know better. You know, I should have. I went through college. I was just as naive and patriotic and believing and naive as all those. And you know, maybe that's what makes such good war protesters out of the ones who are so naive. It's mm-hmm. you fall even further. Mm-hmm. than the cynical ones who know what's going on and mm-hmm. serve. It's the naive ones who see it going on and then they get the realization later.
Yeah, I was a Barry Goldwater Republican when I went to Vietnam.
Too. Hey! You're me, dude.
Now, there's two sayings that have stuck with me. One of our captains that we really loved was named Captain Glenn Mallory. He was the son of a 3-star general. And we would get weapons that didn't fire, 20-round magazines when the guys in the rear had 30-round magazines. All of our packages from home would be cut open, and the guys in the rear would take everything out except the hard candies and stuff and all the stuff. And we would get no supplies and, you know, just terrible stuff. And he always said, nothing's too good for the man up front, and nothing is exactly what he gets. And the other saying was from my grandfather, who was a World War I veteran. He said, you know, the rich people run up the debts and start the wars, and it's us working people who have to pay that back.
Amen.
So. Amen.
Did you have anything you wanted to add, Christopher?
Just that it seems to me sad that the fact that they have successfully overcome the so-called Vietnam syndrome that during the 80s prevented them from using military force openly and massively in Central America, and through maybe the amnesia of the American public, now they can do this kind of stuff, and there's, up till now, not enough opposition in the American public to stop it. That means we have a lot of work left to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could thank you all very much for laying this down. I think it's very important information that everyone should have. And thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.